The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to America's Web Radio. This is Ron Bachman, and today we're going to talk with one of my favorite conservative historians, philosophers, political analysts, global expert in so many different areas. His name is Victor Davis Hanson. He's from the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, and he has a very insightful view of what's going on in Israel and the conflict with Hamas that we're all hearing about every day in the news media. His perspective is firsthand that he has been in Israel. He talks to political leaders over there, and he has a worldwide view of some of the power plays between various actors, both the good and the evil countries, that axis of evil that many of us are hearing about more lately, Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, and all of the influences that the state of Iran seems to be promoting terrorism throughout the Middle East, and all the policies that the Biden administration has had towards giving more money to Iran, freeing up the sanctions that were put in during the Trump years, and the impact of all that that may have worldwide and towards a much larger global conflict. So let me hear from Dr. Hanson. Dr. Hanson, why is this conflict happening now between Israel and Hamas? Give us the global perspective that you may have on this.
Well, the general reason why attack, I think that there was a perception, a general perception in Israel that they had never been wealthier. They have never been more successful. I've been there the last two summers. I talked to a lot of people in the government. There was a general perception on the Israeli part that they had 20,000 guest workers coming in every day nearly, and that argument they had accepted, that these people were very well paid and they were supporting another 100,000 in Gaza. They were ready with the renewal, or the rebooting, I should say, of the Abrams Accord. There had been kind of a, you talk to Israelis, they were kind of relieved that the Iran deal effort to 2.0 had failed. So I think there was a general sense on the Israeli part of complacency because of their sheer success. It was almost talking to a lot of Israelis that they thought, we've been so magnanimous now with bringing in guest workers and we're reaching out to the Arab world, that they're going to look at our success, and they've never been wealthier or more successful. It's just a stunning country to see, just versus 20 years ago. It's got a higher standard of living in many ways than we do here in the United States. And I think they thought that magnanimity would be reciprocated in kind rather than a source of envy and anger that would create a nihilism about people who were not able to do that. And that's just the general atmosphere.
So, Dr. Hanson, what I'm hearing you say is that the Israelis were kind of ambivalent at the moment. They just thought that the world was okay with the Arabs and that they were bringing in people to work. They were raising their income. They were giving them jobs. They were recognizing them being able to cross border to get work. They were supporting them in a number of different ways. They were just content with what the current situation was. They saw the Abraham Accords expanding. They saw the potential of peace. They saw the Iranian deal fall through that the Biden administration was promoting. So tell me, that was the Israeli position. Tell me about what you think that the Palestinian or Hamas view of what was going on and why they decided now to make this invasion that they did.
From the Hamas side, I think they looked at the huge left-wing demonstrations against the Netanyahu government. There were reservists who were not reporting for annual call-ups. There was a sense that Israeli society was bifurcated. They wanted to stop this Abraham renewal that was clear. and they felt that Iran had been given a blank check and they had more rockets and Hezbollah would help them. And that all gave them a sense that the Israelis are not going to be, they have no idea what we're up to. We've been planning this a year. We're going to stop the Abrams Accord. We're going to really shock the world. And then,
well, what about the United States and our political position or our financial position, our policy position? How did the United States attitudes of the Biden administration play into the potential of this this war that's going on?
Final third player in this triangle is, of course, the United States, John. And we in this administration had put Robert Malley in charge of the Iran deal. He is now on. And we in this administration had put Robert Malley in charge of the Iran deal. He has now lost his job. He's lost his security clearance. He was obviously loose, and that's a euphemism, with classified documents. He brought pro-Iranian nationals and Iranian-Americans into the State Department. And that sent a message to Iran that this administration really did want to appease them. They were begging to go back on the Iran deal. The Afghanistan disaster, the $50 billion in weapons, the Ukraine invasion of Putin, our open border, the Chinese balloon, it all cemented a picture that Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran had formed, that the United States either could not or would not do what they did, say, the prior 4 years under Trump. They knew they would not do something like bomb the blank out of ISIS or kill Soleimani. And they thought it was an opportune time. And they didn't think they'd ever have a time like this again.
Well, Dr. Hansen, what do you think was the original intent of Hamas? Was it going to really slaughter all these people? And how do you think this might galvanize people, not only in Israel, but around the world?
I think that their original plan was to go in and take 100 or 200 captives, which in itself would be a coup, and kill some soldiers. But in their bloodlust, they not only killed over 1,000 civilians, but they desecrated, mutilated their bodies. They attacked women and children. They burned them. There was it was pre-modern. It was pre-civilizational. And so they really inflamed Israel justifiably in a way that we had never seen it before. And they've woken up. And the reaction is going to be exactly like the Yom Kippur, except to the nth degree.
So, Dr. Hansen, do you think that Hamas realized what they were getting into, and that I think I've heard you say before, there is just no restraint on what Israel can do today. Politically and globally, there's no restraint on their response to Hamas, which you think they expected it or not?
And I don't think Hamas understands that this is the first time in our life that there's no restraint to speak of. I know Joe Biden will go over there and he'll say, do this and do that and do that, but he's not going to stop this righteous retribution of Hamas.
Dr. Hansen, what about Hezbollah and Iran? Everybody's worried about what they might do. What is your take on the position of Hezbollah and Iran and the potential of them jumping into this conflict and making it even worse, if not global?
And then Hezbollah is talking, and Iran is talking, and beating their chest, and but they don't understand that they're widely despised in the Western. Europe is sick of them, and Europe is clamping down on their own unassimilated immigrant Muslim populations. And we are getting very angry at ours. And I think there's no patience anymore.
Dr. Hansen, what's your take on Joe Biden and the administration's involvement in this whole Middle East conflict that's going on?
Joe Biden is not leading events. He's being driven by events. And if they have 100,000 rockets, I should say, in Lebanon, does Hezbollah. If they get full of themselves and they send, I don't know, 5,000, 4,000 at the U.S. fleet, perhaps one might hit it. A lot might hit it. But they don't understand that there's no patience with them anymore. There's no restraint on the United States.
So what's your take on the involvement or the potential involvement of Russia and China stirring the pot in the Middle East and getting involved even more directly, if that's even possible?
Russia is bogged down in Ukraine. China has two concerns. One, anything that hurts the United States, they're up for. But number two, that what overrides that initial agenda is they don't want 40% of their oil disrupted. And they don't want a big war in the Middle East, not right now with economic difficulties. And what that means is the clients of Iran are not going to be eager to get into a war with the United States or the West in general. And so Iran has no client, it has no backup. And I don't know if they know that. They keep thinking because of the weakness in this administration that it's systemic and it will continue forever. But I don't think that Joe Biden will be able to stop the righteous anger if they do something stupid. And they may well do something stupid because we've lost deterrence.
So Dr. Hansen, while we see all these images on TV of college demonstrations seemingly in favor of Hamas and demonstrations out in public in New York City, Los Angeles, and other places, you even hear some of the celebrity types that are coming out almost anti-Israel, anti-Semitic. But what's going on, in your opinion, in the Democratic Party? Because I have not heard the voices of the leaders of the Democratic Party coming out against Israel. In fact, them being very supportive of what's going on in Israel and giving them that blank check to go ahead and get rid of Hamas, as the Israeli have stated.
So there's a weird calculus going on because there are people in the Democratic Party, not their crazy lunatic squad base, but are very strong supporters of Israel. And they are shocked by this nihilist, blood-curdling support for Hamas's barbarity and savagery. And they want Israel to retaliate. That's not coming from the conservative or the right. That's coming from the mainstream Democratic Party. They are telling Joe Biden, you've got to let Israel go and do what they need to do. And that's very new. And when you have a Democratic president, I don't think people abroad fully comprehend. You have no restraint. Typically, a Republican or conservative administration wants to have deterrence. And then the left, almost in Pavlovian fashion, says this is imperialistic, neo-colonialist, provocative. Trump killed Soleimani. He got blasted for it. Trump bombed ISIS. He got blasted for it. But when the Democratic people are in, there's no restraint because no Republican would say, please don't hit Iran or please don't hit Hamas. And we have their members of their own party who are outraged about what happened to Israel and what Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran are saying, not only about that, but what they're going to do in addition to that. I don't see, when I look at the landscape here or abroad, I don't see any restraining voice that's going to say, you better not do that or else, or you can't do that because that would be amoral or it's against UN rules of war. There's nothing, I don't hear any of that.
Dr. Hansen, these are very fascinating insights, nothing that I've ever heard on any TV or news broadcast, understanding the dynamics of the politics worldwide about this. So, audience, please stay with us. We're going to continue this interview and understanding of the dynamics of what's going on in the Middle East and the war between Israel and Hamas and worldwide opinion governmentally and socially for and against this. So let's listen to a few commercials and we'll be right back.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio. Today we are discussing the Israeli-Hamas war that's going on with Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, one of my favorites. I think you will enjoy if you listen to the first segment, is Unique Insights, and I want to talk to him some more. And I'll start off with this question in this segment. Dr. Hanson, what do you think Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, those last two in particular, are thinking about what restraints they might have, or whether sort of, if you will, the ball's in their court to make a decision as to whether they want to expand this war or not, and what limitations in their own minds might be preventing them from expanding this war further?
Really, if you think about it, the ball is in Hezbollah and Iran's court. They have the braggadocio and the bravado, and we're just going to see if they really want to go to war. I don't know if you saw the economics minister of Lebanon not too long ago, I think 4 days ago, said, if there's a 2006 war again, we're going to be back in the dark ages, because it's been almost 17 years and we haven't recovered yet from the damage the Israelis did. And that was a scenario in which most people thought Israel didn't do well in the 2006 war. But if Hezbollah showers Israel with missiles, they will make Beirut look like a moonscape, and they know it. And I think if Iran thinks that Hezbollah and Iran will destroy the Jewish state, I think at that point they're sorely mistaken, because Israel will go, as I said, medieval on them.
Well, Dr. Hanson, when this is being recorded, the Israelis have not yet entered into Gaza. So when this is actually presented on America's Web Radio or on podcast, the Israelis might have already entered into their ground war against Gaza. But as we are speaking today, what do you think is the capacity, the ability of the Israelis to get into that, what someone think is going to be a house-to-house, fighter-to-fighter, dirty warfare, inner city, going down alleyways that are booby-trapped, getting into tunnels that are have detonations in them, booby traps. What do you think the British, or excuse me, the Israeli forces' capacity to handle that kind of a war is, or what do you think is going to happen when the Israelis go into Gaza?
Well, I think it's going to be a little bit like what the Americans did in Fallujah or Mosul. I was embedded twice in Iraq as a journalist, and they didn't do what everybody thought they were going to do, just charge in there. They cut off certain sections of the city, fragmented them, and then they had civilians go out, and then they had a combined air and ground assault, but they didn't go into individual houses. They blew out the stairways in most of the houses that I could see. So I think what they're doing is they're saying that Biden, they don't want to do it with Biden. They don't want to do it because of the weather. I think they're getting ready, and they want the Hamas people to stool. And I know that's counterintuitive, because people say, well, you need to do it when this horrible massacre is fresh so the world doesn't forget it. Yes, but I think they are going to fragment. They're going to go into a section of Gaza City, and they're going to kill the people that need to be killed. And then they're going to and destroy all the tunnels and infrastructure. Then they're going to go into another one and another one, and they're never going to know which one they're going to go into, rather than just a whole swarm. I could be wrong, but I don't think they're going to do what everybody thinks they're going to do. And I think it's going to be pretty sophisticated. I think the idea is that rather than saying you're going to go into these houses, you're going to find ways to make sure they're trapped in those houses and they're vulnerable.
So, Dr. Hanson, given the tactic, the strategy that you just laid out, what do you think is going to be the biggest problem that the Israelis are going to have to face in that kind of ground attack?
The biggest problem they're going to have is a subterranean war. They're going to have these tunnels go down to 200 feet before they go in the horizon, and they're going to have to find them all, and they're probably going to be stocked with hostages and who knows what, booby trap, as you say. But I think they can handle it, because there's not, I just don't think Joe Biden politically will be able to say to them, you're not going to be able to do this. I think he's going to try to say, we're going to worry about humanitarian things. We're going to give supplies, but secretly they're going to be able to do what they need. And I can't think of a time, maybe you can, in our lifetimes when somebody said, we're not going to restrain the Israelis.
Well, Dr. Hansen, you say there is no restraint that you can see on the Israeli attack, their methodology, their approach to getting into Gaza, controlling Gaza, whatever. Can you explain to our audience a little bit more about the type of restraints that might otherwise take place and what you're really not seeing either politically or in public opinion polls or internationally? What do you mean by that there's no restraints on the Israelis?
But I don't see the restraint on the horizon anywhere now. Not in terms of superpower nuclear deterrence, not in terms of public opinion in the United States, not in terms of the left in the United States, not in terms of Europe. I don't see where some strong voice is saying, you better not do this. It's just not going to happen.
So what do you think is the long-term viability of sustaining the position for the Israelis and their right to self-determination and getting into Gaza? And is there a tolerance in the media to accept it? Or are we going to see the media kind of flip and look at pictures of the Palestinian children being hurt or being part of a bombing that goes on in the local neighborhood where the Hamas may be hiding? What do you see that's going on that may be different in the American media?
But when you see CNN and Anderson Cooper doing a documentary about the horrors that took place, the mutilations, the torture, the burning of people in the kibbutzes, I've never seen CNN do something like that. It was just damning that appeared yesterday.
Okay, so that's an interesting clip of what's going on in the media that we've never seen before from very liberal media. What about the demonstrations that we see in colleges? What about what's going on in campuses and what's happening to the recognition of the craziness that's going on there, maybe by donors or other administrators? What's happening to professors who would be on the far left and have spoken out against Israel? What do you see there?
When you see wealthy left-wing donors to Harvard or to University of Pennsylvania say, we're not going to give any more money, none. You see silk stocking law firms say, we want the names of all the people who supported Hamas. We don't want to hire them. Where I work at a very, very liberal university. I think it's the most left-wing of any major university, Stanford University. But when you have a lecturer tell Jewish students to stand in the corner and see how it feels to be on, and he's summarily put on, what academics do is they put them on leave and they never hire them back. Once you're reprimanded by that, that's equivalent to a firing. And we did that immediately. And so I think higher education in the West in general, but in particular in the United States, has embarrassed itself. People were shocked. They said, we had no idea the level.
So we're seeing a lot of demonstrations from people from the Middle East, from that are Palestinians that are living in the United States and are demonstrating in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, other major cities. They're demonstrating in favor of Hamas, in favor of Palestinians, but also connecting it to that, they're in favor of Hamas, in favor of the terrorist actions that occurred. What do you think the tolerance is in the United States for that kind of free speech and the reaction that might occur from that?
To the demonstrations we're seeing in Los Angeles and New York by first and second generation immigrants from the Middle East, a lot of people now are saying, well, what did you expect? We have an open border with 8 million people came through. We've had 2 years of just a lax immigration. We have no assimilation or integration confidence. And I think it's really shaken up Americans, and there's not a lot of tolerance. Yesterday, Governor DeSantis said that he wanted nobody coming in from Gaza or the Middle East as refugees. And I think that will be almost politically, because he said in a blanket fashion, and he didn't retract it, that they were an anti-Semitic group of people. He didn't want them in the United States. Well, that would be politically toxic just to say that a month ago.
So, Professor Hansen, do you see any political figures in the United States or elsewhere that might understand the need for what's going on in the world and have some ideas or concepts that we can all unite around in any way, shape, or form?
I don't see any major political figure on there. I don't see a Nikki Haley or a Ron DeSantis or Donald Trump or even a Joe Biden or a Robert Kennedy, anybody on any saying we've got to restrain Israel and there it's just a cycle of violence. And the people who did do that, there was something in the State Department, Palestinian Affairs Bureau, it was taken down immediately. Anthony Blinken met with the Turkish foreign minister and said, we need to talk about a ceasefire. And he was met with so much criticism that now he thinks he's George Patton, the way he's talking. So I guess what I'm saying is public opinion is driving this. And I think the Biden administration, maybe unwillingly, but it's floating along with it. It can't stop it. And that's what I don't think Iran or Hezbollah, and we'll see if they're smart as they think they are, but it would be very unwise for them to shower Israel or ships with a gun of rockets, because I think they have the wherewithal to do a lot of damage to both Tehran and Beirut. And there'd be a huge demand in Western publics if that happened.
Well, Dr. Hansen, I've heard you say before that, unlike what we hear in the media, that Iran is, you know, supported by China and North Korea and others, you've had a different take on your understanding of the geopolitical dynamics. Tell our audience what your thought is of Iran and how isolated they may be.
I don't think Iran realizes how isolated it is. It's widely despised by everybody. It's despised by the Arab world. It's despised by Europe. It's despised by North America. It's despised by the English-speaking nations of the British Commonwealth. It's kind of a rogue's gallery. Even Russia and China, convenient allies, they don't like Iran. They don't really want them to be nuclear unless it's going to be, you know, an irritant completely without any exception to the United States. So Iran has no friends. Nobody will rue if they do something stupid and there's a retaliation against them. The same goes for Hezbollah or Hamas.
Well, Dr. Hansen, that is a fascinating description of the geopolitical dynamics that's going on that we don't normally hear through the media or any of the news articles that I read, certainly. So, audience, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We're going to come back and hear more of the wisdom of what's going on with Israel, Hamas, and the whole world geopolitical environment and the dynamics that are going to affect this short-term and long-term. So we'll be right back after this commercial break.
Veteran-owned, America's Web Radio would like to thank all of our incredible patrons. We wouldn't be able to do this without you. If you are not already a patron, you can help us continue to produce some of the most informative and entertaining shows on the internet by becoming a patron. Patrons of America's Web Radio are the first to receive information about new shows and links to the latest podcast episodes. Join now and receive a free gift while supplies last. For more information and to join our family, please visit www.patreon.com/AmericasWebRadio. If you have questions, contact us at gm@AmericasWebRadio.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio as we continue with our discussion on Israel, the Middle East, the war with Hamas, the whole disturbance in the Middle East, the potential of Hamas and Iran, and anybody else that are jumping in and stirring up the pot there. We are just making discussion with all of this with Professor Victor Davis Hanson from the Hoover Institute. And Hoover Institute, for those of you probably know, is a part of Stanford University, a very liberal organization, but the Hoover Institute is sort of a conservative island within that, with a lot of great thinkers there. Not the least among them, and maybe the greatest among them, is Victor Davis Hanson, who's giving us his insights on the Middle East. So, Professor Hanson, what you talked about in our previous sessions was the idea that there is a change in that there are no real restrictions on Israel anywhere that you can see. The Biden administration is promoting it, maybe hesitantly. Maybe they're being pulled along with the events of history. Maybe they're being pulled along by some public opinion, a changing attitude, just being fed up with the Hamas terrorism, as are many other countries in the world. So kind of explain to our audience again the idea that when liberals, if you will, support the work of Israel, they're not going to get any pushback from Republicans, but the initial reaction, the first knee-jerk reaction from the Biden administration may not have been so aggressive as maybe a Republican or a neocon or whatever you want to call them would be. But once they sort of tried to put some restrictions on Israel or tell them to slow down or sort of take a bipartisan approach to, equality of both sides being the cause of this, they were immediately shut down. So give us your perspective on the administration's reactions to the whole Middle East situation with Hamas.
From the left, and given the record of appeasement with Putin, and the disaster in Afghanistan and the lack of reaction to the Chinese espionage escapade, it was a natural inclination of this administration to try to restrain Israel. And we saw that in the first 48 hours with a statement, as I mentioned, of Blinken and on our own State Department website and a few other people, Sullivan and the National Security Advisor. But that there's something going on that's carrying them now, and they realize that that's not viable. So now they're trying to, at the edges, peck around and say, well, rein back the water, or let's have some type of effort to go into Gaza. But they're hitting reality, and the reality is that Egypt does not want to open their country to Hamas. And they will damn Israel to the skies, but they will call Israel up privately and say, we're not going to let them in. We want you to deal with Hamas.
So, Professor, what do you think the big danger is to Israelis in pursuing a ground war?
I think the big danger for Israel is if it would go in house to house and get bogged down and then take casualties and then bend to an opportunistic American demand to do something. That will bring Hezbollah in, and that will bring Iran in. If they go in and they're completely unrestrained and they, as I say, not trying to be dramatic, but they go medieval on Hamas, that will keep Iran and Hezbollah out because they will see the damage that they're seeing right now. And they will say, do we want that in Tehran and do we want that in Beirut? And I don't think they do. And yet they can't predict the reaction of Israel or even for that matter, public opinion in the United States.
Well, Professor, of course, many of us are worried about the expanding war, and we talked about the Israel being unrestrained by any forces out there politically or militarily or across the international spectrum, anybody condemning them or really causing them to slow down. They're all in agreement, let's get rid of Hamas. It's been a sore for many countries for a long time, and they just want Israel to go ahead and clean them out. But this expansion potential to Hezbollah and to Iran itself, I know we kind of on the political side said, well, there's no direct evidence, but we know there's all this indirect evidence and training and funding and all that. And we're kind of giving Iran a pass in many ways when we know that they're complicit in all this. Is there anybody out there that is talking about going after Iran? And what is your thought on what would happen if we actually targeted Iran and said that they are deeply involved in this and we've got to take care of Iran?
I've been kind of amazed at the statements that are coming out. Attorney General Bill Barr, worked for the Trump administration, very anti-Trump, calling to deal now with Iran. Walter Russell Mead, a very distinguished, sober and judicious Wall Street journalist, column saying, whether you like it or not, we're going to have to deal with Tehran. And you have Lindsey Graham. All these people are, it's almost, I think they need to take a step back because, you know, if we deal with Iran, it's not going to be tick for tat, stop, go. If you deal with Iran, you've got to go all the way. And I don't know if they're ready or prepared for that.
Well, given that we're on the brink of these people talking that have some influence and that we're hearing sort of the saber rattling in parts of our governmental leaders and journalists, do you think that Iran really understands the impact of what they have supported in Hamas and Hezbollah, that if they do anything further, if they make a more direct link that we can't overlook any longer, that the repercussions and the expansion of this war and the devastation of their countries is almost guaranteed?
I don't think that Iran or Hamas or Hezbollah quite understand that when you go into a village of villages, kibbutz, a country, and you invade that country at a time of a holiday, and you deliberately massacre women and children, and then you, almost as if they're Aztec captives taken up to Templo Mayor in Tenochtitlan to sacrifice in the 15th century or 16th century, taking these kids back, it was so horrific and horrifying that I think everybody just said, you can't deal with these people. And I don't think that Hamas represents all of the Gazan people. I don't believe in collective punishment. But that said, the images that we got here in the United States of captives that were almost like they were in a Roman triumph in a jeep, or they were ridiculed, and almost a spontaneous crowd spitting on them and yelling, and we want more of them. And you never got the impression that Hamas was facing public, you know, outrage from Gaza. There was celebration at what they were doing. And that, I don't think they understood that. But, you know, Yasser Arafat did when right after 9/11, when they were celebrating our loss of 3,000, he stopped it very quickly and started to give blood so people would not bomb, he thought, Jericho or something. But when you see that unrestrained celebration, and you see some of it in the United States and around the world among expatriate communities, that only furthers this anger. It doesn't assuage it. It doesn't make people say, oh, we better pull back. These people are very angry at us. It has the opposite effect. And no one wants to see a four-year-old Israeli boy taken captive and then have a video made of young Gazan children kicking him and calling him a filthy Jew and trying to ridicule, torture him. The attitude is, whether it's fair or not, is you can't work with these people as long as Hamas is there, and there's going to be collateral damage.
Speaking specifically about Hezbollah and Iran, who are not as active in the war as Hamas is, although I know that Hezbollah has been taking more shots at Israel and even at U.S. bases and U.S. Assets in the region. Is there any hope that these guys will pull back some from what's going on? Can they understand the mindset of Americans, or have they misread, or are they reading weaknesses that they're going to continue to take advantage of? What's your take on the attitude of the Hezbollah and Iran in particular?
And I hope that they pull back. I'm not sure that they're so accustomed to us being appeasing that they don't realize that Westerners have this traditional trait that they take it and take it and take it. And then when you get a particular point, they kind of go berserk. And I hope that doesn't happen. But if they continue to do this, it's going to happen.
In your opinion, Professor, is the president being strong enough in his language, in the actions that we've taken both now and in the recent past? Are our arms stockpiles large enough to be able to handle two wars going on, one in Ukraine and one in the Middle East, and we've got to supply people with arms and munitions and money for them to carry out their missions? What's your take on all that and the ability of the United States to actually handle and support these two wars?
It doesn't do any good for the president to say, well, we're the United States, we're the strongest power. I'm quoting him verbatim in the history of civilization. That doesn't mean anything unless you are. And when you look at the $50 billion, a lot of it was small arms, but nevertheless, $50 billion in equipment we threw away in Afghanistan, or I should say handed over to the Taliban. And then you see the $120 billion of munitions we're giving to Ukraine, and a lot of the stuff is off the books as far as economic support or other types of aid that's not really spoken about. And then you see what we're going to have to give Israel, although they're not, I mean, we're giving Israel air power munitions and we're giving Ukraine more ground power munitions. Maybe they overlap, maybe they don't. And then when you see what China's saying about Taiwan, and then you look at the fact that we're $33 trillion in debt. And all I can say is that after COVID and after the George Floyd and the woke movement, we decided we were going to defund the police and defund the Pentagon. So we actually cut in real dollars the Pentagon, and we borrowed enormous amounts of money to redistribute, lavish. Most of it was ill spent, and we're in a terrible financial situation. And we're under armed given our commitments. In other words, our strategic commitments way outweigh our wherewithal. That being said, the history of this country, if you look at 1917 or 1941, we were more ill-prepared to meet those strategic debt demands than we are now. And it all hinges on at what point does this traditional American light click on that says this is an existential period and you've got to now rearm to the teeth and you've got to change and you've got, and I can see that coming. And I think this country is very lax. It's a very strange country, as you know, but when it finally gets in its head, it has enormous powers of productivity. Its labor participation rate is way under what it could be. There's a lot of labor that's not being used. There's a lot of capital that's not being invested and where it could be invested very quickly. And we could really ramp up very quickly if we wanted to. And I think we're going to do that. And I think there's a sense now that woke is over with, the George Floyd is over with, the COVID lockdown is over with. None of it worked. And it's time to get back to looking at taking a hard look at our universities, our educational system, going back to assimilation, integration of different types of ethnic groups, and closing the border and, you know, stepping back into reality rather than this 2 or 3 year fantasy. And I think someone who's 70 years old now and watched the United States, it still has that ability to recover and react very quickly. And it always amazes me when it really wants to do something. And the amount of talent we have here and wealth, if we really want to do it. And something usually sets it off. If Hamas or Hezbollah or Iran do something like they did on October 7th, involving either hostages or Americans or Israelis again, I think it'll set this country off. I really do.
Well, Professor Hansen, very provocative thoughts and amazing insights that we don't hear from many other sources looking at this from a global perspective and what the power struggles may be and what's going on behind the scenes. So, audience, stay with us for our last segment coming up right after these commercial breaks.
Hey, folks, this is Victor with the On Point with Victor show. Make sure you listen every Tuesday, 1 to 2, only right here on America's Web Radio, the On Point with Victor show. Remember, folks, I'm not angry. I'm just right. And you can find out why every Tuesday from 1 to 2, the On Point with Victor show, only right here on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio in the final session this week of Healthcare Insight, where we're really talking to Professor Victor Davis Hanson, a conservative, brilliant thinker, leader at the Hoover Institute out there in Stanford University in California. And he's giving us unbelievable insights into what's going on in the Middle East, the mindset of Hamas and Iran and Hezbollah, along with the mindset of the United States and the political leaders that he's seeing around the world. It's very fascinating, at least to me, and I hope it is to you, the audience that's been listening in on this. So let me ask a question to sort of lead off this final session, Professor. Typically on the left is what some might have referred to a number of decades ago as peaceniks. There's the Bernie Sanders side that just wants peace and the world to get along and everybody to be happy. Why can't we get along in this world? There's sort of a sense of anti-military spending, anti-military environment that's been promoted by the left and the media and by certain politicians. Do you see any of that developing or the possibility of it developing? And what's your take on what you see in the news media and by leaders, not only in the United States, but maybe around the world?
I don't see anybody in the political realm who's saying we can't spend this money. Everybody's talking about, I'm going to spend more money in defense than you will. Or everybody's trying to say, we're going to have to address the immigration problem. We're going to have to address the university problem. And I mean that from both sides of the aisle. I can't believe what the New York Times and CNN have been writing. I mean, it sounds like for a brief moment in their existence, they believe in America again, and they believe in deterrence, and they believe that the Arab world suffers from endemic anti-Semitism. And that's contrary to the whole woke DEI doctrine and gospel.
Professor Hanson, I hear what you're saying, that the tide is turning against the terrorists of Hamas and the brutality of what's been going on in so many different ways, the terror sponsored by Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah and in Yemen and so many other places around the world that are being supported by some of this axis of evil. Tell us about how you view what's really anti-Semitic language that's growing in Europe and other parts of the world, where it's almost a Nazism type of slogans, you know, burn the Jews, let's kill all the Jews. And it's not just coming from people in the Middle East, but around the rest of the world, there are still these very vocal and well-publicized through the media chants that are so anti-Semitic, it's, it goes back to the Nazis of gas chambers and that kind of horde that just is spewed out against the Jewish people. What is your take on what's happening there?
It is. It's anti-Semitic. And you can even see it in the more insidious. I mean, I support helping Ukraine, but you didn't see any major politician on the left say, we have to stop the cycle of violence in Ukraine, and violence never stopped it, solved anything, and the Ukrainians better listen to us and stop this cycle of violence. They don't have a right to retaliate. It's only Israel that we give those lectures to. And if anybody said to Ukraine, what's the cycle of violence solved? Why are you tit for tat? The same type of dialogue they're using with Israel. Everybody would think they're insane, and yet they get a pass by that attitude toward Israel. I think part of the problem is that, and I'm speaking that we're probably in roughly the same age group, when we grew up in the West, anti-Semitism was more of a kind of a right-wing carryover from the 20s or 30s where people said, you know, the Rothschilds are running the world, or, and it was, but this is, and it was easily identified, and it was discredited because of World War II, et cetera. But this is new, the last 30 years. This is coming, A, from the left, but it's also coming from the diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that tells me that they feel they are exempt because they feel they're marginalized people. And according to the doctrine of anti-racism, nobody who is not white can be guilty of being a racist. So they embolden themselves. And so when we look at what the Black Caucus is saying, or what Black Lives Matter with their poster glorifying a hang glider coming down to kill Jewish children, that's a poster that they had out. A African-American professor at Cornell today, one at Stanford where I work, there's this idea that you can say these things on the left and there will be no consequences because you are a post-George Floyd woke victim yourself. And, of course, anti-Semitism is anti-Semitism. So I think there's a very radical change, and it's going to affect, because they're sounding so heartless, and as you say, so semi-fascist or indeed Nazi-like, that people are repulsed by that. And they were repulsed by the things in New York. They were repulsed by the thing in Sydney. And I think the West in general, and you see it in France especially, the government has outlawed power. I think people are saying multiculturalism doesn't work. It's different than multiracial. We are tolerant of races, but we have to have one common culture. Our universities, these demonstrations, and they show that immigration that is non-meritocratic, illegal, but not diverse, from one region does not work, especially given the lack of assimilation and integration. And they're saying something is toxic in higher education. Maybe we should not give them tax-exempt status for their endowments. Maybe we should get the government out of student loans. We've got to do something because this country is not sustainable with that level of anti-Semitism and hatred. So I see the reaction to it.
Professor, you paint a very interesting picture that this war in the Middle East against Israel and Hamas really sounds like it's a turning point, maybe for much broader changes across our culture, of recognizing that that woke community, that COVID community that hamstrung us for so long, that period is coming to an end, and we're starting maybe to realize this whole diversity, equity, inclusion concept, the woke mentality is really on the way out. So a historical bend of time here, that there is some hope that things are changing. Tell us about your level of optimism about this.
I'm very optimistic because I think people are now saying, yes, they're anti-Semitic, but the problem is even deeper than that. And they showed their true colors when they were on the side of death. They were nihilist, and they were basically celebrating the slaughter of children. And when you get to that point of hatred, something is terribly, fundamentally, systemically wrong with these institutions that allows that. And I think people are going to make some changes. And I think they're very careful. I think the squad, we have these radical Islamicist congresswomen. I think they're very careful now what they're saying. They've got a furious pushback, and they know they have no support for it. When you have a left-wing African-American mayor in New York, Eric Adams, and he sounds like he's an Israeli now, and he's damning the hatred and the anti-Semitism in his city. Granted, he has a large Jewish population, but there are people now on the left saying, this is embarrassing, and these people really do hate Jews. They say they hate Israelis, and anti-Semitism is no longer some crazy guy on the right.
You know, Professor, you mentioned lack of assimilation like we had over our history of people coming in from various parts of the world and ultimately into this grand melting pot that we used to think about. And now we let everybody sort of stay in their own silos and have their own cultures, and we don't have those common issues that bind us. Tell us more about your thoughts of assimilation and people from around the world coming to the United States And instead of assimilating and taking up the basic values and principles of our Constitution, they tend to bring in their own thinking, their own culture, and maybe even their own politics that they had a reason to leave for, but now they're complaining and being anti-American. Tell me what your thoughts are in that very troubling area as far as I'm concerned.
We have so many first and second generation people from the Middle East, and they come over here. And we've been a very generous host to them. We give them prosperity and security and freedom. And yet, when you look at what they're doing, and I say they because there's thousands of them protesting on behalf of these Hamas killers, you want to say to them, stop. Do you think that you could go to Gaza and you could protest and say, I disagree with Hamas? They kill you. You think you could be gay in Gaza? They kill you. You think you could be a lesbian in Iran? They kill you. You think you could be trans on the West Bank? They'd probably kill you. And to come over here and flee that tyranny and beg us to allow you to be part of our body politic and then to voice support for the very things that you fled is incoherent. And so a lot of people you hear that all the time. If you hate this country or you hate everything, why don't you go back where you want to be? And join in with the jihad, and you'll have no freedom, and you'll have no security and no prosperity. But to take advantage of all that we offer you, and then to damn your host, and to damn your host's allies, it's Western. It's so incoherent that it's really counterproductive for the left. I mean, they say apartheid, when you go to Israel, 21% of the population is Arab. And out of that Arab, I think 11 to 12% are Muslim. They have political parties. They vote. They have freedom of speech. They're prosperous. I've been to many of their villages, cities in northern Israel, and compare it to anywhere else in Jordan or Egypt, Syria, Iraq. There's nothing like it. No Arab citizen anywhere in the Middle East has the freedom to express himself and to vote and to worship as he feels, as they do in Israel. And yet we're told by American leftists that these people suffer under apartheid. Everybody knows it's a lie. So lies don't have any currency finally because they're divorced from reality. And I think everybody understands that. And they're getting angry about people who enjoy our hospitality and our comfort and our security and then champion and praise these totalitarian systems that are cruel to people. And yet they lecture us on morality, and yet they're defending a system not just that is hypocritical, but they would never go back to. They fled those systems. And that's what's really aggravating to people.
If you think we're moving to more traditionalist attitudes of assimilation and the basic principles that this country was founded on, what's the public polling or attitudes about these issues that you're aware of?
What's your attitude on the border? What's your attitude about defense spending? What's your attitude about the Middle East? What's your attitude about what happened in Afghanistan? What's your attitude about crime and defunding the police? What's your attitude about energy versus cutting back on fossil fuel? It's not even close. It's 55-60%.
So, Professor, we only have a few minutes left. Can you sort of wrap that up as best you can as to where all this goes politically in the United States?
If we take the personalities out of it and you see what the issues are, the country is center right. It always has been, and it's never more so now. But to reify that or to translate that into a political figure or a political party gaining power to enact that center-right agenda is another thing altogether.
Well, Professor, we appreciate your insights today on the Middle East and the global powers and all the interactions that you've been able to share with us. It's also given me some hope, and hopefully our audience, that our country itself is not going down a left-wing socialist Marxist path, that in fact we're still right of center with a lot of conservative values. We just don't have the political leader that we can coalesce around to actually implement those policies. Well, audience, thank you for your time today, and I hope you will join us again next week on America's Web Radio for Healthcare Insight. We will talk to you next week, once again on the political issues and world issues that affect you and me, your kids, your grandkids. So join us again next week on America's Web Radio.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.